Darker Than Blue by Willis and Shantae of Positive Light Ministry. Welcome to the Qumran Report. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson, coming at you live from Skid Row Studios. Our call-in number is 800-893-9562. You can listen to us live or download our show and any past show by Googling in Qumran Report. Now, this week on the Qumran Report, we will hear some creative voices from the community with Willis and Shantae doing their monthly section entitled Positive Perspective, talking about the spiritual basis of Juneteenth. Also, the graphic artist and illustrator Quinn Salazar and Lava is here with us in the studio to talk about the projects that they're doing in the community and all the way from Australia and on tour here in the States, singer R.L. James. Welcome to the Qumran Report.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Now, look, I'm delighted to have with us in the studio all the way from Australia, R.L. James. R.L., welcome to the Qumran Report.
Thank you so much for having me tonight. Mm-hmm.
Now, can you tell our listening audience a little about your background? How did you get off into music and singing?
When I was 4 years old, I saw a girl with a violin. And I was at school, and I kind of just went to the music department, got myself my own violin, took it home and gave my parents the bill. But before I did, I pulled it out and played it and did the big doys. And, yeah, it started from there, and it just got the ball rolling. And, played violin, got into other instruments. And then my violin teacher actually taught me to sing. I wasn't allowed to pick up my violin, so, mm-hmm. Yeah.
I saw somewhere where your father was a musician also?
My father played the piano accordion. My mother was adopted and actually had a real father who was a double bass blues jazz player. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, what part of Australia did you come from?
I'm from Sydney, Australia. I actually live in a little place called Paddington. It's very beautiful.
Mm-hmm. How's the music scene over there?
It's a little quiet, but, you know, we try.
Okay, now, can you explain why you got off into music and what message you try to send?
Okay, well, I've had a very, very interesting life. I had a few hurdles. I actually got hit by a car and I sat in a wheelchair for quite some time. I lost my memory and things like that. And I wanted to teach people that no matter what you go through, you can mm-hmm. rise above it and you can do anything you want. Nothing is impossible because I'm possible. So mm-hmm. that's sort of my message.
Mm-hmm. Now, you brought in a couple of guests with you. Can you introduce your guests that
I
came
did.
In here with you?
This is Leah from MDA Inc., a tattoo studio in the beautiful Bay Area of San Jose. And mm-hmm. This would be the amazing producer, Just Jay, mm-hmm. Very talented producer, DJ. We're going to be working together. You'll be hearing a track soon coming mm-hmm. up that we've done together since I was here. So, yeah.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Now, can you talk about your tour here in the United States? Tell us a little about that.
It's been a little interesting. I got brought over here for the Three Times Dope tour, and that sort of fell apart after three shows. Festo had his father had a stroke, so it sort of all had to be cancelled after that. So I decided to go I'm possible again and not impossible, and I've been hustling and grinding and finding my own gigs. I think I've done a number of about 8 gigs since those mm-hmm. those first 3 that we did, and I've met some amazing people and networked and made some really amazing connections here, and I'm feeling so blessed that, you know, when the door closed, a window opened with a much better view. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
So you've been all over the United States?
I've been to San Jose, Santa Cruz, Sacramento, San Francisco, Oakland. I'm kind of bad with geography. That's my only downfall. They're the ones that I remember. So,
okay,
yeah.
You got to visit down south. You got to visit the Midwest. You got to visit the East Coast.
Oh, well, I would love to. I'm planning on coming back next year in New York for gigs, so yeah.
Okay, let's play one of your songs, and then we'll come back and talk about it. It's called Truth for Justice. We're going to play a portion of that.
Okay.
This is true.
Okay, Truth for Justice. Can you talk about that? How did that come about?
Thank you. Through being brought over here by someone that I trusted that I maybe shouldn't have trusted quite so much, I decided rather than get upset about it, I would turn it into a positive and make a really sweet track about it. So this man gave me an amazing beat, and I went into the booth, and that came out of it. We did that, I think that was last week, Jay? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You just created this last week.
I did. I went for a walk through Oakland, and I went and actually handed out some of my Simply Dope T-shirts and hats that I gave to you, to the homeless there. And, I mean, we don't have home, like, the poverty like that isn't as, you don't see it on the streets like that. So I went and handed out shirts to people to try and, you know, keep them warm because I was worried about them being cold. And, sat in the park, and I watched a cypher and a little, like, dance crew do their thing, and sat in the park and wrote the words down and then went in and did it. So,
So have you had a chance to visit the Skid Row community here?
I haven't. This is my first time.
I know Bob is going to take you through there. If you go through there, you're going to write another song.
If you give me a chance, I'll write 10.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me ask you this. When you perform, do you perform with a band? When you perform live, you have your own band and all of that?
No, it's just me and a DJ.
Okay.
Yeah.
How would you classify your music?
See, that's the thing that I have an issue with.
Mm-hmm.
I love music. I mean, I play classical music. I play folky guitar. I play the didgeridoo. I used to be a rock singer. The didgeridoo.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have to teach you how to do that circular breathing later. You'll love that. It's a great thing. You look a little silly walking around trying by practicing it, but you'll get it down. For me, it's not really about a genre. It's about a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So
is that the way the music is in Australia? Or is
the music industry in Australia is a little harsh. It's a very small community. Tall poppy syndrome is quite prevalent there. But, you know, we all sort of try and get behind each other when we do things. And I've been shown massive love to Australia, so shout out to all of my Australian friends and family.
Did rap music penetrate the Australian market?
Hip-hop and rap isn't very big over there. People don't really seem to support it. They sort of seem to support the idol shows and the TV shows and the commercial things that are sort of shoved down their throats. So, But, I mean, I love hip-hop and rap. It's close to my heart.
Okay, let's do a piece live. What are we going to do here?
This is a single. It's my single, current single, Lately. Yes. It's my release. It's available on iTunes, Amazon. You can check it out through www.rljames.com.
Okay.
Sorry, shameless plug.
RL James doing Lately.
Lately, all my thoughts confuse my days. Lately, nothing ever changes, it stays the same. Lately, all you wanna do is play games with me. I need a change. I'm so confused, do you misuse? Are you being true? What do I do? I'm so confused. Do you abuse? It's not something new. Can we be true? Can we make this right? Will I win the fight? What will you choose? Too much to lose. We need a change. Lately,
R.L. James. Where would you be? Are you performing anywhere around here in the L.A. area coming up?
Well, actually, on Wednesday night, this Wednesday night, I'm doing a little thing at the Brew Dog Pub in Beverly Hills. Just Jay will be DJing for me. I think he's also going to do a DJ set. We've got DJ Overs. We've got Just Jay, do you want to let us know?
We also got Soul King from the Liquid Crew, the Alcoholics Crew, L.A. Legendary Crew. And, you know, we're going to bring the pain like how we always do, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I've got some friends also from Hollywood Way Studios that are going to bring through some artists that are going to jump on the mic. So a shout out to Dave Aaron and D-Boy at Hollywood Way Studios for, you know, doing the mixes and doing my mastering. They're amazing there. I've known them for quite some time. So.
Okay, that's this coming Wednesday. And let me ask you one more question because we are going to come back around to you. What's the punk rock scene like in Australia?
I actually used to be part of it. I love the punk rock scene. The rock scene in Australia is very strong.
Yeah.
Very strong.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they get a lot of support out there.
Okay. Because in a minute, we're going to go over and we'll be talking to Lava and the Queen. Her husband, he's a legend in the punk rock scene named Gazer X.
Yeah.
Yeah. Come, probably a little before your time, but he's still well known. Okay. Hey. Thank you, Aria. Thank you very much.
Thank
we'll be coming
so
back around
me.
For the latter part of the show. Now, our next guest teaches an artist workshop at the Vortex every Wednesday night at 8:30 p.m. Quinn Salazar, and we got Lava, who's an art model also. Welcome to the Coonrod Report, Quinn.
Hey, everyone.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Now, can you tell our listening audience about your background? How did you become an artist?
Well, it's kind of just been my whole life. I really haven't had a point where I haven't been making art. I don't have a memory of not doing that. Mm-hmm. So it's just something I always took to.
At what age did you start? Yeah.
As soon as I could hold like a marker in my hand, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been thinking about my process, at least. I have pretty good memories of taking it pretty seriously around probably age 4 or 5 at that point. But, yeah, it was just—it's just always been something I've just really been interested in, just creating my own worlds, creating characters, and I'm really more of a storyteller. But I do it through, I guess what you could say, like visual means. I like to represent it in that way. It's also kind of like a just something that's like always in my head. I always have like some kind of story or like some kind of ongoing like. Maybe like character dilemmas or something, things that kind of just play out on their own in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like, it's kind of how I can make sense of the world. I have to like pay attention to it, but it's almost like it's guiding me more than I'm guiding it.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say I necessarily make up stories. I would say stories make up me to some extent. Usually stick with like certain themes for years at a time. It's kind of always been my process. Like when I was like a little boy, you know, I was doing stuff like pirates or cowboys and that kind of thing, but you know, as I got a little older, I started doing a lot of like futuristic war stories and then started moving into kind of this project I've been working on now called Sea of Kansas, which is probably the only one I've really decided like I want, like really set on finishing, really set on like a really set story. It's pretty much it's like kind of like an alternative universe type of comic book, really. It's kind of, it has like a noirish feel to it, but the way I try to express it visually, it's almost as if the entire 20th century happened all at once, but it's also kind of got a backwards timeline. Like instead of going from 1900 to 1999, it goes from 1999 to 1900. So when people are talking about things that happened a long time ago, it's more like the 90s, the 80s, the 70s, and then things that are happening in the present, it's more like the 20s and the 1910s. So I'm kind of trying to play around with that. The idea of it is it's a federal investigator is trying to find the answer to kind of this dilemma he finds. He's trying to find out what the Sea of Kansas is.
The Sea of Kansas.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's an apocalyptic narrative, so it's going to eventually culminate with the end of the world. So it's kind of like what the title is about, essentially, like trying to find a place that doesn't exist or trying to find yourself in non-existence.
Let me ask you this. Did you study comics as an art form as an artist coming through?
Not initially. It's something I guess I've been doing longer than I thought about. I mean, I never, like, grew up with anything like superhero comics or anything like that, because it's kind of like what a lot of people think when you say comics. They think, that kind of thing. But I wasn't even allowed to like watch like Ninja Turtles or Batman or anything when I was a kid or get into that. And parents thought it was too violent. So I kind of like drew references mostly from historical stuff. That's really what I'm into is a lot of historical narratives. Fiction mostly, but I really like to look at like, you know, period and just like the time frame and the kind of mindsets that dictated that.
Let me ask you this. How much have the computer age changed the creativity of an artist? Have it enhanced it, or you think it have taken it away from it?
I think it's just another medium to work with. I know a lot of people are... I do hear that fairly often. I majored in digital media when I went to Otis College of Art and Design. I did a lot of traditional like types of mediums, like when I was there, like pen and ink and drawing and that kind of thing. But I think the digital stuff is just another way to use it. Because I do a lot of drawing in the computer as well, and that's how I make like most of my living, is doing digital artwork, a lot of lately motion comics and that kind of thing. So I can do a lot of the same things in that. Sometimes it's quicker. A lot of what is faster. I can distribute it quicker. If I draw something like right away, I don't have to like sit down, scan it. I can just post it on the internet or just send it off to whoever my client is like right away. But
well, let me ask you this. You know, you got classic pieces like, just say, from Da Vinci, all of these great works. Do you think when they look back 100 years from now that anything would be produced from the computer age like that?
You know, it's kind of hard to say because the way we're storing, storing knowledge and storing media is completely different. It's kind of like in its own universe in a way. It's all electronic. So, I mean, if we're going to be looking back on things that are electronic, I'm not really sure. It's so unstable right now. You know, some of it might not even be around because it's so easy to lose it. You know, I mean, like, for instance, like my sketchbooks or something that, you know, unless, like, something physically destroys it, it's still going to be around. But digital stuff, you can just drop it and it's gone. You know, so it's much more sensitive.
I'm going to jump in on this. I work with a lot of photographers, and they have this conversation all the time, film versus digital, and it's kind of what you're asking is, tactile art versus computer art. And from my point of view, it's always going to be about the idea, you know, whether you have songwriters or artists or any kind of visual media, like movies and filmmaking and stuff. It starts with the idea. So if you're looking in the future and you're wondering if there's going to be a Da Vinci or a Michelangelo, in their time, that was progressive. You know, that they had a past too. So we look back on it as if it were great, but it started with the idea. So as long as we're having good ideas and we're working from a true place of creativity, you know, one thing that does happen, especially in areas like fashion or songwriting or art even, is that because the world is so consumer-based now, we have a lot of knockoff artists that they just want to copy whatever's been done. And so the originals get swallowed up because it's so different. It gets shoved to the side, or because it can't be put into a certain genre, then they don't know what to do with it or how to sell it. And if it's not a sure sell, then they don't really want to take a chance because it's all about the money game right now. So what I'm finding is that underground art is that much more important these days because of the huge consumer pressures. And people, I think, are starting to look for more unique sounds or visuals or any type of art that isn't so commercial, because that's all they see everywhere. You know, you have huge artists like Britney Spears or, you know, and it's like it just floods your world, so that if that's all you're seeing and hearing, it becomes a little monotonous and you get a little bored with it.
Because, in relationship to music, I think when I was coming up, like in the 60s, when you didn't have a lot of computerized music, where you had to bring it, you know, you couldn't make up music coming through. And I think about that now. It was just so many great musicians. I mean, all over the world. I mean, it was just outstanding.
And there still is. And I think with art also, you know, there's still great artists, even if they're working on the computer, but their ideas are what makes it great or not. So whether you're working in a sketchbook or a computer, where your heart is and where your imagination is coming from, I think that's what's going to matter to your audience. You know, as an art model, mm-hmm. I do enjoy people working on pads of paper because I can hear the pencil and an experience.
Tell us a little about what, now, what is that? What's the art?
Okay, so my background is I went to school for fashion mm-hmm. at Otis, the same school Quinn went to, and worked in fashion for years and got really burnt out. I figured it wasn't for my soul. But in the meantime, I had been introduced to art classes where you would have either a nude or costume model that you would have to draw from. And this is how professional artists learn how to draw the body and clothes or not on the body. Mm-hmm. So when I got out of fashion, I was at a loss. I had no idea what I was going to do. I just, like Quinn, have known mm-hmm. I was a creative person from very early age. Mm-hmm. So I knew it was definitely going to be something creative. And my friend, who was an art model, said, well, you've had ballet, you've, you know, been hanging around all the sort of hippie type of people who don't mind being naked in public, and why don't you try art modeling? Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, I get to be paid to just sit there, but, you know.
Is the money better? Is the good
well,
money
it's not you? About that. It's a very sacred interaction that's happening. You have to understand art modeling and artists have had relationships since the dawn of man because the body is such a interest to us that whether you're wearing clothes or not, we like to capture those beautiful moments of movement. You know, people love dancers, and it's this ongoing thing of trying to capture, you know, any mm-hmm. kind of art, I think, is always trying to capture the truth of beauty. Mm-hmm. That's the way I like to see it. So, you know, a lot of people misunderstand what Quinn and I do because there is nudity involved. We have sort of a joke that, you know, what I really do versus what people think I do. And he's got a cute little comic about, you know, we take it very seriously and it's very sacred. And we're talking about anatomy. And, mm-hmm. of course, sexuality is involved with it just because you're nude. But that doesn't come into play usually because it's more of a classroom type setup. But when you tell people, yeah, I'm a nude model mm-hmm. for artists, they think you're back in Paris in the 20s, just like hopping on the tables and doing hoochie-coo,
but that's not the way to
become a professional. You know?
During the Harlem Renaissance period, it was big. You had an artist called Carl Van Vechten, and he used to really, all of you noticed personalities throughout Harlem. You know, a lot of them in nude, too. You know, he used to. He was a sketch artist, and he did sculptures and all of that. Okay, we're going to come back to that in our roundtable. One more question I want to ask you. Quinn, mm-hmm. can you tell us a little about the workshop on Wednesday? It's over at the Vortex at 8:30. What's that about?
Well, that's kind of what Larva was talking about. Pretty much what we're doing over there is just trying to find, like, a nice, like, casual space to pretty much teach, like, about the human form and kind of like bringing like a different like variety of talent and mm-hmm. just, you know, it's something that like I feel very strongly about much mm-hmm. in the way Larva does. It's just like a good, because I'm very obsessed with like people, like drawing people. That's been my thing for a long time. So I really like to just try to find like something I can do pretty much as a professional to, you know, bring in other people and see what they're doing and teach them and just have a community built around that. People mm-hmm. like understand and appreciate that.
Is it sculptures too, or just sketch artists?
Pretty much just drawing. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of like people bring in whatever tools they want. Mm-hmm. But if you're interested or if anyone else is, like, we do it every Wednesday. It's at 2341 East Olympic on Corner Street, Santa Fe. It's over there in downtown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, Quinn. Thank you very much. We're gonna come back in our community roundtable and open it up to everybody. But at this time, let's go to our community calendar, and then we're coming back for Positive Perspective with Willis and Shante.
This is the community calendar of upcoming events. Celebrating 20 years of excellence in Black theater from 1994 to 2014. The Roby Theater Company presents the first Paul Robeson Theater Festival, Friday, July 18, 2014, and Saturday, July 19, 2014. The location of this event will be at the Los Angeles Theater Center, 514 South Spring Street, Los Angeles 913. This event will be a presentation of 16 20-minute original short stage plays about Paul Robeson. And a special stage play will be about Paul Robeson, presented in puppetry art form. And more information about this event will be forthcoming. But at this time, you can contact the Roby Theater Company, www.robytheatercompany.com, or 213-489-7402. Also, the Roby Theater Company is presenting at the Vision Theater an evening of six scenes, the classical through the contemporary. And this is Saturday, June 28th at 7 p.m. Presenting a Roby Theater Company ensemble directed by Ben Guillory. The location of the Vision Theater is 3341 West 43rd Place, Los Angeles, California, 9008. The seating is limited, so please RSVP, and you can contact office manager at robytheatercompany.org or call the Roby office, 213-489-7402. Suggested donation at the door is $10. And if you have a community event that you would like announced on our show, send the information to Drama Stage 1, attention Earlene Anthony. And our call-in number for the show is 800-893-9562. Now, back to our host.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Earlene Anthony. Now, our next guest, Positive Perspective from Positive Light Ministry, will perform the Paul Robeson Puppet Show at the first Paul Robeson Theater Festival Saturday, July the 19th, 2014, at the Los Angeles Theater Center, located at 514 South Spring Street. And I would like to play just a little short clip by Paul Robeson, while he was in Australia.
Back to it, so I would say the Africans and the American Negroes have turned out to be an extraordinarily gifted people. The great tragedy is that by not making us full-class citizens as yet in America, they may be losing, I don't know how much yet. That's all. And to come back, I would say that unquestionably, I am an American, born there. My father's slave there. Upon the backs of my people was developed the primary wealth of America. The primary wealth. You have to have accumulated wealth to start, you know, to build. You did it another way here in Australia. You had to build your accumulated wealth too. You just came and took it. You know what I mean? And that's what they did in most of the countries. It's what you West. It's what you Europeans did. You just took it. We got to catch up with you a little bit. So in America. So there's a lot of America that belongs to me yet. You understand? But just like a Scottish American is proud of being from Scotland, I'm proud for being African. Now, in our school books, they tried to tell me that all Africans were savages till I got to London and found most of the Africans I knew and were going to Oxford and Cambridge and doing very well and learned their culture. And even once somebody had the temerity, after one had conquered the Chinese people and imposed upon them the opium trade and everything else, to suggest that they were a backward people, just the people who had been civilized so long over the rest of you folks didn't make any sense at all. So somewhere, it was wonderful to find about the colored peoples of the world that they were very advanced. So I would say today that I'm an American who is infinitely prouder to be of African descent, no question about it. No question about it. I'm an Afro-American, and I don't use the word American ever loosely again.
Now, this was the feeling that when you're in London about 1937-38, you really had the world at your feet then. I mean, you're a tremendous success, you're recognized all over the world. And yet you went back to America. This was the feeling that took you back?
I felt I had to go back to my people. That's right. The going was tough. And today I can go back. I just had my passport renewed. I could go back to pretty tough times now. But any time I could get a telegram next week that the Negro people had gathered somewhere in one of their conferences, as they could, and say, Paul, in the difficulties that are going on in America, would you come back and help us? I would take the plane as soon as I finished my engagements.
Okay, that's Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson talking about his relationship to America. Now, at this time, I would like to turn it over to Positive Perspective.
Always mad, they color me bad because I ran with the riffraff. Before I gave his glory up, this story was rough. I suffered through truculent times. I was blind and lost. I often vision my coffin.
Yeah, that was Here I Am by Pastor Ben Seiler of the Bright Hope Worship Center International in San Bernardino, California. Hi, I'm Willis Boyd.
And I'm Shantae Duncan.
And you are listening to Positive Perspective. Where we shine a positive light of Jesus Christ on the scriptures, music, and our communities and world issues. Tonight we will be discussing American slavery and Christianity and how that relates to Juneteenth celebration.
The Juneteenth celebration dates back to June 19th, 1865. And before we get into the Bible discussion, we just want to give a shout out and congratulate Melvin Johnson, Earlene Anthony, and Judy Bowman for their success with the Juneteenth celebration and the 101 Club play reading last Thursday. It was an awesome event, an awesome turnout, and we just want to thank you guys for having us as musical guests. It was a great experience, so thank you.
You're absolutely. I'm very proud.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Okay, so what I'd like to say are what we do is usually have a discussion in studio. You guys are free to pipe in and if you want, if or not. Okay, but a lot of the African Americans believe that Christianity was pushed on them by their white slave masters. And we want to try to get into a little discussion on that. And you want to read that scripture?
That's Acts chapter 8, verses 26 to 38. Now an angel of the Lord said to Philip, "Go south to the road, the desert road, that goes down from Jerusalem to Gaza." So he started out, and on his way he met an Ethiopian eunuch, an important official in charge of the treasury of Candace, which means queen of the Ethiopians. This man had gone to Jerusalem to worship, and on his way home was sitting in his chariot, reading the book of Isaiah the prophet. The Spirit told Philip, "Go to that chariot and stay near it." Then Philip ran up to the chariot and heard the man reading Isaiah the prophet. "Do you understand what you are reading?" Philip asked. "How can I," he said, "unless someone explains it to me?" So he invited Philip to come up and sit with him. As they traveled along the road, they came to some water. Then the eunuch said, "Look, here is water. What can stand in the way of me being baptized?" And he gave orders to stop the chariot. Then Philip and the eunuch went down into the water, and Philip baptized him.
Okay, my point, I guess, or what we can discuss is, this was, I'm not sure, is after the death of Christ, but he was an Ethiopian of great importance. And I'm sure he went back home after being baptized and spread that good word. And so what I'm getting at is how many Africans received Christ just like he did, and was that part of the faith of Christ? Is that what helped them get over the ocean in those boats over here? And then is it part of that strength or that faith from Christ? And that's speculating, because they had a lot of beliefs. And any one of them could have gotten them through. But to say, I mean, what do you think? American slave, Christ and their white masters, pushing that? I mean, what do you believe? Anybody?
Well, I can only speak as a former Christian. I was raised Catholic, and so as a child, I didn't really have a choice. Mm-hmm. And I can't even imagine American slavery to begin with. But I think what your point is people finding faith or having it be forced upon them. So I think that both could happen. Both are true. And for me, for someone to have faith on their own without it being forced onto them has something to do with finding truth. I spoke of finding truth concerning art and music making and filmmaking, and I think the same thing is relevant here, where we're always trying, as humans, we're always trying to answer these bigger questions. Who am I? Why am I here? What am I doing? What am I supposed to be doing? How do I become a better person? And I don't think race has anything to do with that. I think how you answer those questions are what we're talking about. So whether Christianity was a learned behavior for the American slaves or whether it was forced, I think both are possible. I think that the African communities already had a deep understanding of spirituality on their own accord and had you know, huge rituals and traditions that have been carried on and have not been carried on. So I don't think it's a black and white yes or no kind of question. I think there's many facets to it, and I think it revolves around seeking truth.
Yeah, but I think also, like you say that, but we were having a discussion, Shanti and I, about Christianity as far as in the black community or in the African American race or in the United States. And yet, I mean, a lot of us are not worshiping the trees or the snakes and that. It's Muslim or Christianity. A lot of the, I guess, the original African traditions have, I mean, fallen by the wayside. But Christianity has, you know, it's grown in the African community. So,
sure.
Do you understand what I'm saying there?
Mm-hmm. And you know, you always had that conflict before the creation of the Catholic Church. You know, that was one of the things that brought the Catholic Church together at the First Nicene Council, 325 A.D. They had to decide that problem because you had Eastern Christianity, which came mostly through the African nations, Ethiopia, Egypt, like that, Coptic Christians. And then you had Western Christianity. I think when Constantine, he was the emperor at that time, when he decided that he wanted to make Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire, he didn't realize that you had these two trends that viewed the teachings and the Messiah Jesus different. Of course, this was about 300 years after the time of Jesus and the Apostle Paul. And they viewed him different. You know, in the Western world, they were used to polytheism. So they viewed Jesus as a deity, you know, as the God. Whereas in the Eastern world, he was viewed as the Messiah, the anointed one, which was a whole different term. And so at 325 A.D., the First Nicene Council, I think July the 4th, that's the real meaning is July the 4th, not the one they celebrate, 325 A.D., they came together to decide this issue. And out of that came the Roman Universal Church, the one they call the Roman Catholic Church, which this is an organization that really gave modern Christianity that doctrine that they use now. Of course, we got the King James Version of the Bible, which came years later, 1611, something like that. But I think we're still looking at these two issues, because one of the things that happened with Western Christianity is that they were used to all of these type of holidays that we talk about, Easter, Christmas, the cross, all that kind of stuff. And what the Roman Catholic Church was able to do is to put it in a form that we have it today. That's why they still dealing with a lot of these rituals. But you still have the same kind of segregation in the church. I live in the MacArthur Park area, and one of the things that I noticed, because I used to come up, and I used to, they used to always say that the most segregated moment is on Sunday morning.
You don't believe that's still true?
I know it's true because to the extent, you know, there's a great spiritual movement that's among the Hispanic community now. You know, I live right in front of a church, and I mean, they really get down the way we used to get down in the South. And I still notice that it's still basically segregated. You know, the blacks have their form of worship. Mainly the majority of the whites have their form. The majority of the Hispanic have their form. And the minority is the ones who mix their particular type of doctrine and all of that. And the strange thing, it is where you you find a lot of openness and what I think the modern interpretation of the way people look at the scripture that seem to come away from these segregated areas. That's why you have that they would look at something like same-sex marriage or the way that they view humanity as a whole is different from these conservative churches.
I'm not understanding what with the same-sex marriage, and I mean, what are you saying?
All I'm saying is that it seems that when you have the mixture, just say of the whites, the blacks, the Hispanic,
they're more open to
they seem to come out of this conservative past. This is what we're dealing with in the Islamic world right now, where they're killing each other. They still back in the 7th century dealing with all these doctrine, and here we is in the computer high-tech age.
So you're thinking I'm getting off of
topic? I had a question, though. Like, were you saying the minority churches were more accepting of same-sex as opposed to African?
No, I'm just, what I was going to say is because people with different races and religions can get together, you think that that opens up an acceptance to same-sex marriage? Is that what you're saying?
No. What I'm saying is that where you have the mixture of the different races that's coming together and
you have
integrated
more open-mindedness, that accepts same-sex marriage?
When you look at it, that's what you
see. I understand what you're saying.
In that sense, they are more opening. And then when you have the conservative community just go back, they're the ones that's basically fighting against a lot of modern things that's happening.
And do you think that's wrong?
Well, I can't make that. I have to leave that up to the creator. I can't make a value judgment on that.
Good answer.
Only thing I can do is point out what's happening.
So Africans were Christians before they became slaves. So do you think that that's something that allowed them to endure, you know, the suffering and stuff that they faced?
I don't, because the majority of the Africans that came up over here, a huge majority, didn't come from Christian nation. They came from either Islamic nation or what they would call pagan, because at that time in Africa, you really had only two, Egypt and Ethiopia, and slaves, they didn't come from that area. See, so the huge majority that came to the Western world come up out of the Islamic countries, or either they was pagans, see. And so they wasn't even exposed to Christianity.
So what you're basically saying is that they were exposed to Christianity through their white masters. Because, okay, so basically the church, church.
Proof of that is the King James Version of the Bible. You know, that's the standard in the Christian faith. You know, the King James Version of the Bible that came from King James, that come up out of England, et cetera, like that.
Well, it didn't come from King James. It was just translated by King James. So I'm not fully understanding what you're saying there. It was translated by King James. It didn't come from him.
When I say what's translated by King James, that's the document that we use today that right. didn't come from Africa.
Mm-hmm.
It came through the Europeans, through after slavery, through the slave master, basically the type of religion.
So it basically wasn't Hebrew or Greek that he had translated into English. Is that what you're saying?
The King James Version of the Bible was translated from the Greek.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Something I've noticed actually, a lot with religion. Oh, sorry.
Excuse me. Actually, King James did not translate the Bible. He appointed 59 scholars to work on the translation. Mm. So many for the New Testament, so many for the Old, and so many for the Apocalyptic. Okay. It wasn't his, just well, King
it was
James.
By his, yeah, it was by
it was his authority.
Yeah, by his authority
right.
it was done.
So when we say King James, it gets a little lost in that. It wasn't actually King James.
And what was you?
Something I've noticed a lot about religion, my family is actually Jehovah's Witnesses. They sort of asked me to leave when I got to a certain age because we had different beliefs because we were just different.
Yeah.
But I have noticed religion does bring people together. It gives people hope. It gives people a feeling of belonging, and it helps them to get through tough situations like you are talking about. And no one should be treated that way. And you know, we all bleed the same blood. And the thing is, we are all looking to feel like we belong and to have that belief and to have that faith in our lives. And, you know, I've found my own, you know, my own beliefs and, you know, coming to terms with that and coming to terms with being kept away from my family because of a religion,
mm-hmm.
You know, that is something that I look at religion and I see a segregation within religion itself.
Yeah.
But I also see the coming together of people. I would love to go to a gospel church while I'm here. That's something I've always wanted to do. So I'm going to try and do that while I'm in LA because that would be beautiful.
Okay. Go ahead. We're winding down. We have a few more minutes.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
Maybe you can go to the Church of the Nazarene at 6th and San Pedro.
Okay,
they are a lively bunch. Plus, on Wednesday night, they have a karaoke.
Oh, yeah.
That's Wednesday well night, known. I have a gig.
And it's right there in Skid Row, so you can write a song.
Are you,
do we need to wind it down?
Busy.
Yeah, we have 2 minutes.
Two?
Yeah.
So more discussion?
Yeah, we I guess we got about another 30 seconds before,
okay,
because I want to get some contact information.
So was the church the only organized institution that the white man allowed the slaves to participate in, or
because it was actually through the church, I believe, that bought slaves to where we are now, because slaves were emancipated with nothing. And a lot of them suffered more cruelly than when they were slaves because they had no knowledge of what freedom was or how to provide for themselves. And,
because I know we're winding down, but I just like to say one point, and then we'll go around for some closing comments. But you also have to look at that it was the Christianity, those that practiced Christianity, that pushed the Atlantic slave trade. It was Christians that did that. Not just Christians, you know, mm-hmm. Christians, Muslims, Native Americans. They were involved in this. They was the last one to actually be involved with the slave trade here, mm-hmm. you know. But that's a whole nother subject.
Yes.
It's so interesting. We want to wind it down.
Uh-huh.
Can we run around real quick? I need to get the contact mm-hmm. information of everybody.
Yeah, for Positive Light Ministries, our website is mm-hmm. positivelight.org, and you can find us on Facebook. So facebook.com/wearepositivelight.
Mm-hmm.
And for Figure Drawing at the Vortex, you can find us at meetup.com/figuredrawingvortex. And if you'd like to RSVP or want any other information, you can contact me, Quinn Salazar, at 909-618-4395.
For R.L. James, Sydney, www.arreljames.com. That has all my social media links on it, all of my contact information there, so you can mm-hmm. check that out. And there's videos and music there as well.
Okay. Now, I would like to extend a special thanks to my guests, R.L. James, Quinn Salazar, Alava over there, Willis Boyd, Shantae Duncan. I don't want to forget Alava. Willis Boyd,
My name's Just Jay, UrbanUmpires.com. Run a musical studio that I engineer a lot of artists out of Oakland, but I grew up in Brooklyn, so I kind of bring the best of both coasts.
Okay. Hey. Thank you very much. Now, thank you for tuning in to the Qumran Report. And from your host, Melvin Ishmael Johnson, may the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. I leave you with the song, Here I Am, by Pastor Ben of Bright Hope Worship Center.
Always mad, they color me bad because I ran with the rip rap. Before I gave his glory up, this story was rough. I suffered through truculent times, I was blind and lost. I often vision my coffin, my mind was off. So empty inside, I never cried, ready to die. Now I seek eternal life, stepping towards the light. All the friends I thought were tight, now cold as ice. Cause I'm not ashamed to shout his name while clapping my hands. I let the music bump while I jump, stomp, and dance. Singing his praises, I'm raising my amazing Lord high. Escaping the burn from lessons learned, eager to fly. At you with a mouthful. To stay obedient, I use the Lord to strengthen me. Because this world may seem come so easy. Thought I could hide when I was doing wrong, but then it came. Like boom, bang, dirty laundry's at home. My wife was gone, but her faith in Christ made her come back strong. Cause he said the tone to bring was dark into the light, right? Now I'm a shiny knight, armor for Christ. The former prepared for the rain because he paid the price. And now I flee from the greed. He's all that I need. No stress on my chest because I'm blessed. He had mercy for the unworthy. Now I'm thirsty. He's thirsty for anything else because